not taken or not to be caught off guard by Trump having this talking point that just on the surface may sound real nice. But if she thought through it, I wouldn't she have realized that that many in the Democratic Party even are supporting the Raise the Wage Act, which would actually end this idea of a subminimum wage altogether.
That's right. And she did, to her credit, whereas Trump just talked about getting rid of taxes on tips, Vice President Harris did start by saying we need to raise the federal minimum wage and perhaps we can also exempt taxes on tips. But what we need to hear from both of them, what we need to hear from everybody is let's end this subminimum wage for tipped workers. It's a legacy of slavery. It's been a source of harassment and racial inequity and poverty for way too long. It needs to go. People need to be paid a full minimum wage with tips on top. That's what we need to hear from everybody.
Where is that conversation right now? Your organization, One Fair Wage, has been working state by state to ensure economic inequality gets addressed through basic, not just minimum wages, living wages, wages one could thrive at. So where's that campaign?
So, there has been this federal bill that you mentioned, the Raise the Wage Act. It passed in the House in 2019, again in 2021. It just hasn't made it through the Senate yet. I do think it can pass eventually. But when it comes back into play, it needs to be a higher number. 15 is no longer livable anywhere in the country, and it
Right,
needs to
15
end.
would have been appropriate maybe 10 years ago, right?
That's right. That's right. If you look at the MIT Living Wage Calculator, even for the cheapest county in the United States, that's McClellan County, Texas, you need closer to $20 an hour to cover the basics of rent, food, transportation. So, we are pushing for what we are calling a living wage for all. We need a minimum wage that's closer to the cost of living in this moment and that ends all subminimum wages. Tipped workers need a full minimum wage, so do workers with disabilities and youth, incarcerated workers, gig workers. Anybody who works in America should get that minimum wage. After all, that's what the word minimum means. It means you don't earn less.
And this idea of exempting tips from taxes, another thing that's not really being said is it goes hand in hand with the conservative effort to defund government services, right? Because really what they want is to reduce government revenues so that the government can actually spend money on social safety nets. The smaller the federal government's treasury is, the better for conservatives. But of course, they don't put it in that term, just saying, let's end taxes or let's lower taxes is this very quick and easy way to get people thinking that's the way that they're going to be able to financially survive. But the other end of that is that means that we sort of absolve ourselves from being collectively responsible for one another financially, right?
To take it a step further, the Republican bill introduced by Senator Ted Cruz, following Trump mentioning this idea of no taxes on tips, the bill that accompanied that rhetoric not only got rid of, is not only proposing to get rid of taxes on tips, it also actually is proposing to get rid of taxes on hedge fund billionaires. So they were trying to use this issue to get rid of taxes on tips as a Trojan horse to really get even more tax exemptions for billionaires. That was their real intention. And so again, on our side, if Vice President Harris is going to support this proposal, it's got to be clear that it's only for workers, not for hedge fund billionaires. And it's got to be clear that the most important thing we need is one fair wage, a full minimum wage with tips on top.
Saru Jayaraman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
My guest has been Saru Jayaraman, president of One Fair Wage and director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, Senior Editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Jordan Ifueko was only 13 years old when she first wrote her debut novel, Raybearer, an Afro-fantasy fiction piece for young readers. When the book was finally published, it ended up on the New York Times bestsellers list. Daughter of Nigerian-American parents, Ifueko wanted to see characters like herself in fiction and literature. Today, she's just published her third novel, The Maid and the Crocodile. In addition to upending racial stereotypes, Ifueko's new book also subverts tropes about essential and domestic workers. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Jordan Ifueko.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So it's quite remarkable to think about the fact that you were only 13 years old when you wrote your debut novel, that... you know, had you bursting onto the writing scene. It's hard to imagine, you know, for me, who's almost 50, to think about what I was doing when I was 13. I was certainly not writing. And that's quite remarkable. So why don't you begin by telling us what it is that has motivated you to write, especially from such a young age, creating these fantastical worlds?
Well, I always have found that when people start writing really young, it's to have an increased sense of agency, right? There's so much you can't do, you're not allowed to do as a child. And for me in particular, I was actually homeschooled until I was 13. So not only did I have, you know, kind of the limitations that an ordinary child did, but books, media, special movies, television shows were some of my only portal to other experiences, to find out what it was like to live as a different kind of child in a different community.
And did you find that, especially where young adult fiction was concerned, there weren't enough protagonists that looked like you or had your background, or there just wasn't enough representation? Because of course we all, when we see ourselves in fiction, it empowers us.
Oh, absolutely. I think, if anything, writing stories, writing the world of Eretzar, which is the world of the Raybearer books and The Maid of the Crocodile, it was the only place where I felt like all the parts of myself could be represented, right? If I were to read a book growing up and there was a girl like me on the cover, she was either an enslaved African-American or someone growing up in the projects, right? And these stories were very important. Like, they reflected real African-American experiences, but my experience was made up of so many things. Like, my parents were Nigerian immigrants. I grew up in California. I had all of these fascinations with different government structures and royal families around the world. I was just as likely to hear as a kid a West African folktale to go to bed as I was to hear, you know, the Narnia books, you know, right? Mm. Nigeria was a British colony until the 60s, and my parents were growing up during that time. So I had so many influences, and yet if I saw anyone who looked like me in a book, it seemed to represent such a narrow part of my experience, because I did experience racism. So it was cool to see that reflected in the books, but I never got to see myself as, you know, the leader of a country or someone who is even a narrative about a Black teen girl falling in love, like a rom-com, non-existent in teen fiction when I was growing up, right? There's so much more to all of us other than the specific narratives that wider majority white, overwhelmingly white publishers think is valuable. And so to get to experience all the parts of myself through my own stories was really healing for me. Although I will say, when I first invented the world of Raybearer when I was 13, I didn't feel like I had the permission to make it as unapologetically Black and multicultural as I did when I rewrote the story later in my 20s, which is when it actually got published, right? Mm. When you're a kid, you generally look to what's already been done to get a sense of what you have permission to do. So I did have too much kind of pride to make the main characters white, but I also didn't feel I had permission to make them black or South Asian coded or East Asian coded and all of the wonderful, cast of different ethnicities that ended up in the final book, right? So instead, I tried to be as vague as possible. It's hilarious reading these initial drafts because I gave them like these kind of Afro-Latiny names, and their clothing was kind of shapeless robes, and their skin color was just kind of like this indeterminate brown, sometimes tan, sometimes like I just didn't feel like I had the permission to say, this is a dark-skinned girl with 4C curls, and she is in an empire that is directly inspired by the Yoruba Oyo Empire, right? Which is what made it into the final book. I didn't feel like I had the freedom. I didn't feel like anyone would care or anyone would want to read a book that so specifically celebrated certain cultures. And now it's interesting that I think some people will now try and pigeonhole the book too much into those cultures, right? They'll read Rayfarer and think, oh, are these like genuine Nigerian rituals they're doing? And I say, I mean, they're inspired by some, but they're also inspired by other religious rituals I found interesting. Because at like my core, I'm a fantasy writer, right? I think it's a lot of pressure on writers who are people of color to basically make their work educational primers on the culture that they come from, which is unfair, right? Like nobody goes to Tolkien expecting Lord of the Rings to be an educational primer on Welsh culture, despite the fact that Welsh culture heavily influences Lord of the Rings, right? But white authors are given freedom to be imaginative, to be creative, to make up worlds on their own instead of being expected to educate a largely white audience on where they come from, because that's what a lot of publishers think people will find interesting about your book, right? Not the fact that it's a coming of age adventure and all of these other beautiful things about the story itself, right?
So the fact that it's fantasy and that's your genre is, of course, the most freeing part of it, I imagine. That the point is you get to create these worlds. And I'm wondering if you also subvert not only the fact that subvert not only the ethnic heritage, if you will, of the protagonist and the entire world, but also the power dynamics, right? Because we grow up reading fairy tales about princes and princesses, and those are not necessarily. Well, tell me about how you subvert power dynamics in your books. That there's really a strong trope around workers and domestic work, if you will.
In The Maid and the Crocodile, there is a strong shift from the focus of the Rayfarer books, which are an independent duology. All three books are set in the same world. But the Rayfarer books explored this world from the top down. So the main character is at the upper echelons of society with the emperors, with the decision makers. And at that time in my life, that was what was important to me to represent a young Black girl doing, right? That was the kind of agency and power and reverence that I had not seen applied to Black girls. And so it was important for me to tell that story. However, especially after the labor movements of the 2020s with essential workers and all the wonderful like unions and fighting back that's happened in the years since, it became equally important to me to examine this world from the bottom, from the very bottom. And it's something that you don't see in fantasy a lot. You generally see fantasy explored from the perspective of people with power, even if it's people who don't realize they're powerful, like secret royalty, right? Like she was raised in the slums, but really she's a princess, right? Or she was raised in the slums, but in the end she marries a king or becomes crowned head of this empire, right? So a happy ending in fantasy generally involves either, it involves getting powered. It involves leaving your lower class, your working class, and ascending to a more respected class. And this is often, even in the most progressive fantasy teen fiction, right? And it bothered me because I'm just like, what does that say about these working classes that actually make the world run, right? I wanted to write a fairy tale that had romance and suspense and adventure, but the happy ending was not her leaving her class, but changing the world to respect her class and her profession, and making a world where she could have good working conditions, right? Like, I joke about The Maid and the Crocodile, you know, even though it's a romance, the happy ending is an employee-owned establishment, right? It's not necessarily the kiss that happens at the end, even though the kiss does happen at the end, and we're all happy about that, right? She doesn't stop being a domestic worker. She simply changes her community and her environment so domestic workers have the respect that they should have. She talks about her work being sacred. You know, she talks about, I think one of my favorite quotes from this book is, I was still suited to labor, but no longer, it seemed, to servanthood. You know, because there's nothing wrong with labor. Labor is beautiful, it's wonderful, it's necessary. But servanthood and subjugation and exploitation, that's what makes it horrible and unsustainable and a misery that you're trying to escape from, right? And that kind of goes through in other themes too with disability, right? In maybe older fairy tales, her disability, she has a maimed foot from being made to work in a child labor factory when she was younger. In an older fairy tale, that would have been magically healed by the end. In my fairy tale, her community presents her with like the first ever elevator, right? So she doesn't have to use stairs anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just, it's a different kind of approach to who the main character should be and what a happy ending should look like.
So there's, it basically sounds like you're saying that in a fantasy, one can manifest this idea that the world needs to evolve to be able to fit those of us who aren't made welcome in the world as it exists now. And that's certainly aspirational for the real world, right?
Of course, yeah. I think one thing I wanted to directly challenge is the myth of a superwoman or superman who is good enough and virtuous enough and powerful enough that they alone can change the world, right? Like, we need these leaders. We need, like, and that's very much kind of the style of the Rhaebar books. It's just like she rises and she learns what's wrong. But the second Rhaebar book, Redemptor, very much examines how quickly an individual gets burned out. Like, you need to rise up as a community in order to change the world and change your circumstances. And I think it's a trap to think that any one of us, just with our single agency, like, you know, kind of like the power was in you all along narrative that's really common in fairy tales. My book challenges that. I think that the main character does have to learn not to accept her place. She has to learn not to subjugate herself. But the power was in her community all along, not necessarily just herself, right? You know, she can inspire a community to act together, and she does, and it's wonderful. But it actually says something that might be fairly controversial, which is that on her own, she was not in a position to long-term change her circumstances, right? That's a community action. It requires organizing and gathering together in order to speak truth to power and get agency for everyone.
I'm wondering if you can read a section from your new book, The Maid and the Crocodile, which is part of the series. I guess I don't want to say it's the third in the series, in the Rhaebar series, because as you said, it's a standalone book, but it is in the universe. It is your third novel. Just to give our audience a sense of a flavor of what the book is.
Absolutely. So I'll start start off with a short summary of the book, which is that it's about a disabled teen domestic worker with the power to change people's fates by cleaning their houses. And it's a profession known as curse eating. And the wealthy people of this magical city she lives in are very interested in her ability. So here's her talking about it a little bit. Curse eating is a very old profession. It is born of an idea that unfortunate people attract bad spirits away from wealthier, more fortunate ones. As a result, curse eaters are both shunned pariahs and celebrated luck charms. Daughter getting married? Pay a jilted spinster to touch the girl's wedding clothes. Foul spirits, people believed, would leave the bride, seduced away by the curse eater's loneliness. Buying a new cow? Have a dying person clean its stables. Demons would flock to the curse eater's broom, leaving the heifer to calf in peace. As a child, I had been a popular choice for curse eating in Dejitown. Being a limping, spirit-touched orphan will do that for you. The previous curse eater, a near toothless man named Popo, always reeked of palm wine, was getting old, and so the village was eager for him to train an apprentice. I worked for Popo on my days off from the sweat mill. The first question I asked him was, "Can you see the silt?" To which he yawned and replied, "Eh, you are talking nonsense, small girl. Go and clean the yam farmer's house. They are expecting a new baby any day now." I learned quickly to not bring up my sight again. Being small Shade, whose foot got smashed in the sweat mill, what a shame, was hard enough without having addle-brained added to my title. Mama Shade, my mother, had explained my singing sight to me. At first, when I spoke of silver slush and glowing spores, she had been as confused as I was. But the closer she got to death, cheeks burning as I held her in my arms, the more she caught glimpses of what I saw.
That is Jordan Ifueko, my guest, and she's reading from her new novel, The Maid and the Crocodile, a young adult book in as part of the Ray Bearer series. She's a New York Times best-selling author. And in the last few minutes of our conversation, Jordan, let's talk about the publishing industry briefly. You sort of alluded a bit to it earlier, which is that, as writers, people certainly struggle with this question of what do publishers want? What are they willing to publish? They are the gatekeepers of an industry that lie between the creators of fiction, such as yourself, and the readers of fiction. And you would like to think that they know what they're doing, but not always. And the publishing industry certainly has changed as we've kind of become a more diverse nation and pushed for more diverse literature. So what were your challenges that you faced finding a publisher? Do you feel that things are more amenable, the industry is more amenable now to writers like yourself?
Yes and no. I do think that my ability to get a Black fantasy novel published was far higher in 2019 and 2020 than it was even a few years earlier. I credit a lot of that to kind of global phenomenons like the Black Panther films, which had recently come out, and all of a sudden, these gatekeepers saw our stories as a trend that they could hop onto. And that's a dangerous word, trend, because what really should happen is that the world of literature should mirror the world we live in, right? Which has, a global majority of non-European cultures, right? All of whom have been barred from these industries for various reasons. I was very fortunate to get in when I did, but I worry for new writers, all of whom have these beautiful stories, and how much harder it is in some ways for them to get in than those of us who got in at kind of this golden window of time when they were suddenly interested in stories that weren't European centric, right? Because historically, there is a tendency to allow in a limited number of quote unquote minority voices. And then, you know, the higher ups in these publishing industries might think that they've fulfilled their quota, right? You know, we don't need another Black fantasy author. We already have one, that kind of thing. I will say that I'm impressed specifically with my specific publishing team, especially my editor, who seems to genuinely really want to widen the categories of stories that are published long term, sustainably, and that's really beautiful. But the industry at large makes me worry. Because what I saw is all of these talented writers of color, especially Black female writers, getting inspired by this new generation of Black fantasy writers. And it delighted me until I started hearing years after I got published how much harder it was for these writers to break in. So we still have a long ways to go. I've seen Black writers who are being inspired to start their own traditional publishing imprints, which is wonderful. But those are really hard. You're going up against these dinosaur giants that are huge and have more resources than you do, right?
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate the time you've spent with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Jordan Ifueko, New York Times bestselling author of the Ray Bearer series. Her new book, The Maid and the Crocodile, is just out. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation.